welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and professional speaker, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free Author 2.0 blueprint and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 296 of the podcast. It is the 21st of November as I record this, on the day it goes out, because I was tired yesterday and had a day off. I'll talk about that in a minute. But you might be able to hear that there's a massive rainstorm outside in Bath today. It is a classic cold, raining winter's day. It's lovely living in the West Country because it's so beautiful. But one of the reasons it's so beautiful is because it rains a lot. Today I have an interview with Gabriella Pereira about her book and website, DIY MFA. And we have a good chat about the writer's need for validation and whether degrees are needed. I definitely think they can be valuable, but in case you don't know about my own degree situation, I have a master's degree in theology from Oxford and a postgrad degree in psychology. So nothing about writing, business or marketing. So my whole life now is based on stuff I've learned on the journey as such, like I've taken courses and read books and just learned on the job by just doing it. So my study interests, kind of official degree interests, come out in my fiction. But yeah, it's a good chat that we have today, and Gabriella's super fun. So in publishing news today, this week, I think the biggest news is Amazon Advertising has opened up to non-KDP select authors. Now, this is brilliant, and I'm very excited about this. It's an ad platform that I have heard some people doing very well with, although many people have not done well. And if you tried it when it first came out, as I did, probably 18 months, 2 years ago, it didn't work very well. But Amazon uses machine learning and it's got a lot better. Now, if you listen to the Sell More Book Show, Jim and Brian were talking about why, you know, Jim was like puzzled as to why they would open this up to non-KDP select authors. And I think it's because Amazon is primarily a data platform and they are always trying to find more data to see what works. So why wouldn't they open it up to more authors in order to collect more data? I don't think it's a money play. I think it's a data play. So really interesting. So Amazon Advertising. And remember, I linked to everything in the show notes, which you can always find at the creativepen.com/podcasts, and just go to episode 296 for this one. The other thing is Kindle Unlimited has launched in Australia. And so clearly the KU model is working for Amazon, which means they'll continue to push it into the various stores around the world. And I've been thinking about this because one of the sort of main issues that many authors have talked about is, you know, Amazon has loads of power. What if they drop the royalty rate from 70% to 35%? Now, for many people, 35% is still better than what you'd get from traditional publishing. Some people are getting 25%, some people are getting 10% through that way, but 70 to 35 would affect a lot of people. Now, I've been, because I just put up end of days for pre-order on Amazon, I had another look at the KDP dashboard. And if you look more closely and you're not in KU, you get these messages that basically say, if you're in these countries, Japan, or if you're, you know, the books that sell in these countries, Japan, Brazil, Mexico, India, you only get 35% unless you're in KU. So this has already happened, just not in the big earning markets, the big revenue countries. So if this is the model going forward, I think that I would expect Amazon to switch the model at some point for, you know, to benefit authors who are in KU. So this is the thing. I'm really happy about the Amazon advertising being open. And of course, I love Amazon, but I am looking at this KU model and going, they're going to start, it's already squeezing, because as we grow our businesses into these international areas, we're going to see the squeeze in these percentage split. And of course, India is a place that I would dearly love to sell more books. And Amazon is going all out in India. However, Japan, Kobo is owned by Rakuten, which is a Japanese company. So I would expect that to be different. And certainly Brazil, Mexico, the Latin American countries are going to, they have other ebook retailers. So I don't know, there's still pros and cons. You guys know I am a happy person for going wide. Kobo sponsor the show. I love getting income from multiple streams of income. But probably in 27, what I'll be... 2017. I will be, as I've mentioned before, I'm going to be doing a sweet romance trilogy with an author, and I am going to be putting those books into KU. So I have, at the moment, I have 18 books wide, I think, and the other two, I will actually be going back into wide for the other two, but the new, a new series in a different author name, I'm going to go on KU and try and explore some of these other options and possibilities. So I just wanted to talk about that up front. I'm also looking at getting into Google Play in 2017, and you know, it's one of those, again, one of those platforms that has pros and cons, but some people have recommended Streetlib, so I'm looking at that for next year too. My to-do list is massive. The other thing I wanted to mention is the new book from Christine Catherine Rush, who, you know, I just hero worship, which is Closing the Deal on Your Terms, and her new book on agents, contracts, and more, working with publishers. And especially because yesterday I read an article in the Sunday Times about Carrie Fisher, who has a new book out. And of course, she had an affair with Harrison Ford. Not that that's news really, but the bit that was more interesting to me is that she said she wasn't expecting much from Star Wars when she signed the contract, and she signed away the rights to her image. Now, presumably she got a couple of grand or something when she signed that contract. But basically she signed away the rights to her image in perpetuity. So all the Princess Leia figures and, you know, all the merchandise that are related, that's related to her image, she didn't get anything for. So she's basically broke. And Star Wars is the biggest franchise ever. So I wanted to mention that in conjunction with Chris's book, because you don't know how valuable your book and your world is going to be. And if you sign away rights, if you sign a contract that means you're cut out of it, you just don't know what will happen. So protect your rights. Something else happened in this arena this week. I mean, because I learned so much about this in the US on Chris and Dean's course. And I think they are talking about doing a workshop on copyright and contracts online. So please go to Dean's blog and tell him you want that too, because I want that to happen. They need enough people being interested. But basically, I had a company approach me and say that they were interested in licensing one of my characters in the London, the Arcane world, for a board game. And seriously, only a few months ago, I would have been all in. I would have gone, yeah, that sounds awesome. I'm really cool with that. And one of my characters would have become a character in a board game. But if you license one character, you're then entangling your rights. Because what if a studio wants a deal on the Arcane world, wants to make movies, or a big gaming company wants to make like a series of games? Or, you know, what if there's a big opportunity? If I've licensed one character who's actually quite a main character, well, he's a secondary character, but he's still an interesting one. You know, and he comes into all the books. So if I license the rights to him, you know, how does that affect a potential deal on the rest of the world? And I just think it would be more complicated. So I said no to that opportunity. And yeah, felt quite good about it, because I understand far more now the potential for my rights. So I wanted to share that. That was interesting. I also wanted to recommend Chris Fox's book, Six Figure Author, Using Data Science to Sell More Books. That's out now. Chris was on the show a couple of months ago, and we talked about or even a month ago, it was one of the recorded ones when I was away. It is a short read, but really useful and different to my model in that Chris says, if you're someone who doesn't want to put all your eggs in one basket, then his model is not right for you. Basically, he's like, yes, put all your eggs in KU, then go and get more eggs and put more eggs in KU. So he's kind of going deep and narrow with his income, and I'm wide with my income. So model people who make a living the way you want to, but definitely check out Chris Fox's book. I also thought I might start doing a little futurist segment because the news is so dire at the moment and so full of predictions of doom and so much negativity. But there are some awesome things in the world, and everyone needs to realise the world is getting better. You know, there's ups and downs, of course, but overall, the world is getting better. So a couple of things that I found this week. Kevin Kelly's interview on Creative Live with Chase Jarvis about his book The Inevitable, which I read earlier this year. And Kevin said, which I thought was exactly right, he said, humanity is 52% good, or even 50.2. But the point is, it tips into the good. I mean, a whole lot of it is bad, but there's enough people working on the good side that we will invent answers to the problems. You know, he's positive we can solve climate change, or at least reduce it before we all get fried, and positive that AI will help us, not kill us. And just the real positives of expanding technology. And he talks about self-publishing. And I love Kevin Kelly. He's one of these guys who just is so accepting of the world as it is, and doesn't try and, you know, say, well, it should be this way. It's like, well, this is how people are behaving. And he does talk about the move from people of the book to people of the screen, which is really challenging for authors. But I really thought it was a great positive take on emerging technologies. So I'll link to that in the show notes. And also, I read Scientific American, which is always full of amazing stuff. I also read Wired, which is great, which incidentally Kevin Kelly started. But Scientific American this week, an implant has enabled a woman paralyzed by ALS to communicate by thought alone. And this is at home and not in a lab, which is just, I think it's gobsmacking. She imagines her finger clicking. So she can't move, but she can imagine her finger clicking and use that click to communicate or play games or stuff like that. And a click can be very powerful. So this is obviously a start in this kind of mind technology, but it's really amazing, and it just made me go, wow, we live in an awesome world. Plus, if you need some light relief, we watched The Secret Life of Pets yesterday, and it was awesome. So, yeah, go and check out that movie, silly movie, if you need to smile. Right, again, this is a long introduction segment, but so many of you said you enjoy the intro that I'm just going to keep doing it. So my personal update, obviously things are a bit crazy as I'm still trying to wrangle my to-do list from my trip away. But I've also been reminded of Seth Godin's blog post a few years back about creating a life you don't want to escape from, because I'm so happy to be home, and I actually love my work. I love the podcast. I love my books. I love writing. I love all the stuff that goes along with my work, the marketing and the business side. And I actually, you know, it used to be when I had a day job that a holiday was, oh goodness, I get to escape my job and I'm so happy to, you know, get away from it all. And now I'm like, I actually really like working. So yeah, try and create a life you don't want to escape from and you'll be happy all the time. Also, we did, but you know, we also enjoyed our time away, and Jonathan has just finished editing a walk through the old city of Jerusalem video, and I'll link to that in the show notes, or you can find it on youtube.com/thecreativepen. That's a sort of little walk through the old city, and you'll see me he captured me taking selfies of myself and you know, in the bazaar and stuff like that. So, and it's full of quite interesting things. It's only two and a half minutes long, so that will be in the show notes. I did manage to focus on what was important this week, and End of Days has been edited, sent to my editor. It's on pre-order or ebooks now, and due to go out 31st of January 2017. So I'm ready earlier, I mean, as in The book's actually better than I expected, which I'm so happy about. You know, when you leave things a while and you're like, oh, I hope this isn't really bad. And then it's pretty clean. So I'm very happy with it. And so that's with Jen. And I might even attempt to get the audiobook done prior to release, so it all drops on the same day. And the reason I'm waiting till January is just because there's a whole load of things that I'm planning for 2017. And I kind of want to take advantage of the 30, 60, 90 day things on Amazon for JF Pen. So yeah, I'm really going to make an effort with JF Pen brand next year. Also, I did a full day seminar on Saturday in London with Orna Ross on how to make a living and a life with your writing. And yeah, it was a great day. And that's why I was tired yesterday. I'm always very tired when I do sort of speaking. We had 45 people and it was fantastic. And even though I'm really tired, it's definitely worth it because the benefits of speaking live mean you actually see realization dawn on people's faces. You actually see the impact that you make in the moment and when they get it. And it's awesome when people like get this. And, you know, I always try and communicate my enthusiasm for this life. And a lot of attendees seem to find it really useful. And many are listening because we had a show of hands and a whole lot of people listened to the show. So hello to everyone who came on Saturday. And it was a great day. Thanks so much. Okay, so also a few people emailed to say that the interview last week, the little one at the end, was in mono, which was in your different ears. And also there was a gap in the edit somewhere in the so sorry about that. That was me being tired. I'm tired again today. So, but following on from those issues and what I talked about last week in terms of my big plans, I am looking for more freelancers to work on specific things. And I do have, you know, obviously I can go to job boards and things, but I would like to ask the community first because, you know, if you get me and you get my voice, then that would work a lot better. And also I like to keep the money go round in the community. So, you know, maybe you're someone who's been listening to the show and like my VA, Alexandra, pitched me as a VA over a year ago now. She'd been listening to the show for years and heard me say I needed help and pitched me and we've been working together for a year and it's awesome. So what I need is someone to help with podcast production because Alexandra's internet for big files is really slow. So I am looking for someone to take some of the tasks off me, someone to produce the audio segment and schedule it. And there's a few steps. I have a process. I just need someone to do the process and you need to have good internet connection because the files are pretty big. I'm also looking for a copywriter to help with new versions of sales pages and emails. So that is a copywriter, you know, specifically for converting text. I'm also opening up to guest posts, which is the more, you know, not paid version. And it needs to be specific and targeted and useful. But if you go to thecreativepen.com/guest posting, you'll see the guidelines if you have ideas. And if you're interested and you have questions, email me, joanna@thecreativepen.com. Okay, so thanks for all your emails and tweets. So many of you said you enjoyed the update episode a lot. And I'm always very grateful that you're interested in my journey. And we're all on this journey together. So I'll keep sharing and you keep creating. Just a couple of people. Jamie said, I really love the podcast today. Very exciting. I admire your ability to re-examine your goals and opinions based on reliable information and make adjustments. Thanks for your transparency. Thanks, Jamie. I really appreciate that. And I do, you know, we can't help but change our opinions as things change. This world is changing so fast. I think if you're holding to what worked even a year ago, you know, you're going to have to change it up. So, yeah, I will keep telling you what I'm changing. Jez De Silva says, one of your best podcasts ever. So happy for you and Jonathan. You deserve every success. Thank you. Thanks, Jez. And it's so fun. I always find it so funny that people enjoy the personal stuff because it's just me. You know, it's just little old me here in Bath. And yeah, but I appreciate it. I really do. I find it hard to say how much I appreciate it, but oh, I'm going to cry. Let's move on. Alex Laybourne says, great show. Got me thinking about plans for the future, combining day job and writing plans and vision. Fantastic. And yeah, I in terms of that planning, I'm going to mention I'm going to mention the planning thing in a minute. It's coming. Anna Proofing, oh, this is a great tweet. Anna Proofing, at Anna Proofing on Twitter said, listening to your podcast as a quiet thing to do took the edge of a shield to the head today. #Vikings, #battle training. And that's so funny because I just love the thought of Anna out there fighting with shields and, I don't know, axes or something, and getting hit on the head with a shield and lying there listening to the podcast. That's just fantastic. Go, Anna. Sarah Beth Martin, final one, said, listening to the wonderful podcast while at the day job. Thanks for keeping the dream alive. And as I said on Saturday, actually, what was really interesting, what came out of the Saturday thing, is a lot of people were, I thought we would get a lot of more advanced authors, but a lot of people hadn't even finished their first book. But I applaud the ambition of the group. But we ended the day by saying, okay, one of your goals is to make $1 online. If you haven't made a dollar online, then make that first dollar. Because if you can make $1, you can make $10. If you can make $10, you can make $100. If you can make $100, you can make $1,000. And then you can do that every month. And if you can make $1,000 a month, you're not far off doing this full time. So I hope that's encouraging. And the dream is alive. You know, this is possible. Okay, so moving on. Sponsorship. Today's episode is sponsored by my own new webinar series. After doing a number of Facebook Live events this year, a lot of people really enjoyed the Facebook Live and got a lot out of it. So I want to give more to the community as we move into 2017. So I will be doing more live training, so where you can come along and I've been doing webinars mostly with other people, but I'm going to start doing my own. These will be live training plus Q&A time afterwards. So it will be like, 45 minutes to an hour of presentation, and then Q&A for 30 minutes to an probably 30 minutes because I'm pretty knackered after 90 minutes. And I have, you can find out more at thecreativepen.com/learn. And we are doing how to write your novel, 7 Steps to Write Your Novel on 11th of December, How to Make Money with Books on 18th of December, and join me during the holiday period on the 29th of December when we'll be doing planning for 2017 production and marketing schedules, as well as an in-depth Q&A, all free if you attend live. And I'm trying to do these on a Sunday, so hopefully people can come. So thecreativepen.com/learn. So this kind of corporate sponsorship pays for the hosting and transcription, but my time in producing the show is primarily sponsored by you guys. So a massive thank you to all the people supporting on Patreon, especially the long-standing supporters who've been doing over a year now. You guys are amazing. And thanks to new patrons, Darian Chavez, DNC Copywriting, Charles Eugene Anderson, Rhonda Ride, Grace Green, Jennifer Gillam, and Carolee Dickerson. And there were some others who wanted to remain anonymous. So thank you if you wanted to remain anonymous. I really appreciate your support too. As I've said, I really do appreciate the Patreon support, like the tweets and emails. It demonstrates you enjoy the show and want it to continue. You can give just a dollar per show to a maximum of 2 shows a month, so less than a coffee a month, and you'll get the extra monthly Q&A audio, which I'm about to record after this. So I'll be, if you're a Patreon supporter, you'll be getting your notification of another show, as if you haven't had enough of my voice today. You can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. You can tell I'm tired. Apologies. Let's get on with the interview. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com, and today I'm here with Gabriella Pereira. Hi Gabriella.
Hi, Joanna. It's so great to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you on the show. Just a little introduction. Gabriella is a writer, entrepreneur, podcaster, and author of the DIY MFA. Write with focus, read with purpose, and build your community, which is a fantastic book. And we'll be getting into that. But first of all, tell us a bit more about you and your writing background.
Oh, where to start, right? Like that's a huge question. I guess I'll start by saying I've done a lot of random things in my life. And so it's all kind of come full circle to where I am now. So in a past life, I was a psychology researcher. Back in the day, I thought I wanted to develop developmentally appropriate toys for kids. So I studied child psychology and I went to school for graphic design. I actually worked in the toy industry for a while, did all this stuff. And then I kind of decided to switch gears and start writing children's books. So I went to an MFA program in writing for children. And it's sort of funny because at this point, people go like, they ask me, how did you end up doing DIY MFA? Like, you're working with writers and adults. Like, where'd the toy stuff go? And I find that question to be so bizarre because in a sense, I'm kind of still doing the same thing. I'm just building cool educational stuff just for grownups who like to write instead of for preschoolers. But it's all the same sort of muscles in my brain, like the same creativity that has to go into developing a really fun toy is kind of the same that has to go into developing a conference talk or developing a writing class or something like that. So in the end, I see it all as the same thing. But people who have known me for a long time will look at my trajectory and be like, whoa, what happened?
So. Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of us end up doing lots of different things. I did psychology as well in a postgrad degree. Yeah, I mean, I think psychology is one of those things that if you don't do it for a job, it's still really useful in so many ways. But I want to come back on the MFA thing. So MFA, Master of Fine Arts, if people don't know, and usually for our end, it's creative writing. So you said there about doing yours in a children's MFA, but I wanted you to just generally, why did you want to do an MFA? Why do people in general think that a degree is going to help?
So I wanted to get an MFA for exactly the wrong reasons, but unfortunately, that's the reason that I think most people get MFAs. So let me explain. I was basically just starting out. I was a newbie writer. I mean, I'd been writing in college. I was an English major. I'd, you know, done some dabbling in creative writing as a young person. But it was really in 2007 that I sat down. I was like, all right, I'm going to make this writing thing happen. And I kind of felt like I had gone as far as I could go with community writing classes. Not to like rag on those classes. They're very good. But, you know, I'd sort of tapped out what I could do in the sort of informal writing class realm. And I sort of felt like I needed someone else to anoint me as a writer. I literally had this idea in my mind that at graduation, after I got my MFA, I would be sitting there in the, you know, the pews of the church where the graduation ceremony was, and somehow the skies would part and this beam of light would come down and angel choirs would go, ah, and all of a sudden I would be a writer. And of course, that totally didn't happen. And it was actually at that very moment when that didn't happen that I had my light bulb moment and I realized, like, oh, you don't need to get an MFA to do all of this. And you can kind of do it yourself. And that's when the seed was planted for DIY MFA. And I guess you could say the rest is history.
And yeah, we'll come back to the book and everything that you're doing. But that need for validation is, I think, what you're talking about. So as a psychologist as well, how do people get over that need for validation? So you obviously, that was maybe a couple of year process from you deciding you wanted to do it to you realizing you didn't need it. How do writers develop the confidence to give up that need for validation or get it in other ways?
Well, I would say that you never really give up, right? Like, this need for validation essentially comes from imposter syndrome. It's like feeling that we aren't enough, that we're not living up to what we should be doing, or we haven't, you know, like that somehow people are going to find out that we're not really a writer. And so people feel that they need to have that external stamp of approval as sort of a way to shield them from having to give themselves that stamp of approval. And I'll be honest, even now, after I have a book published, I've been doing DIY MFA for a long time, people will like send me, I'll get emails from readers who will be like, it's so great to hear from an established writer. And I look at them and I'm like, I'm not an established writer. Like, what are you talking about? But you still have that feeling of imposter syndrome. And I interview a lot of authors on the podcast, and people who are big name authors who've had, you know, top of the bestseller lists, and they still have that feeling. Mm-hmm. So I think part of the issue is that people who are in creative careers, you need to embrace that imposter syndrome is just part of your life. It's never going to go away. But what you can do is develop tricks and sort of like little mind tricks to redirect or channel that imposter syndrome energy into creative work, or sort of find ways to validate yourself. But also recognize that, like, it is always going to be there, and you kind of need to learn to live with it and work around it, not try to erase it altogether.
What are some of your mind tricks, just while we're on that?
Oh, I can show you. So this one here, this is my angst jar, right? And you can see it's pretty full. So this is a jar. I keep it right here on my desk, where whenever something bad happens or something that causes me any sort of creative angst, so I get a rejection letter, I get a nasty email from a subscriber who doesn't like something that I wrote or I said or blah, 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 I honor the fact that, like, this happened, because I find a lot of times people will try to just shove that emotion under the rug and say, oh, I'm just going to erase it, or, you know, forget them, don't worry about them, and sort of throw the critics aside. And that's a defense mechanism. But what it does is it kind of glosses over the fact that it feels really crappy to have rejection. Like, you need to honor the fact that this hurts. So I write myself a little note, and I'll usually put a little note on the outside sort of reminding me what it is, but I don't ever actually open these again. I just put them in the jar. And then every time that feeling of angst comes up, and it comes up over and over, it usually takes me several days to get over one of those notes, but I'll sort of remind myself, like, okay, it's safe in the jar. The jar has it. Let's get back to work. Mm. And that sort of redirecting allows me to sort of honor the fact that, yes, that feeling exists, but I've put it somewhere where it's contained and safe, and now I can get back to work.
Ah, that's great. I have a ton of stuff on my wall, and I keep thinking I need to do a blog post on it, but I do change them up. One of the things I have is, you know, how is today going to impact your body of work over my lifetime? And as, you know, none of us know how long our lifetime is. And, you know, as you said, it's in the jar, get back to work. And I'm like, okay, I feel crappy about this, but how is me feeling this way going to help my body of work? And what I need to do is focus on creating rather than, like, destroying myself.
Well, that totally goes along with one of sort of the tenets that I have in DIY MFA and when I work with students, this idea of not compounding the pain of the emotion with additional angst or stuff. Mm-hmm. And usually the way this works is, you know, for example, a writer who doesn't do their word count, or they miss a writing day or whatever. And what do? They flog themselves and they beat themselves up and, oh, I didn't write my words today. Well, whining about it doesn't make the words magically appear on the page, buddy. Like, you gotta just sit down and write. So at the end, that's a moment where I will put it in my angst jar, and I'm like, all right, I feel crappy about the fact that I didn't write my words today. Put it in the jar. All right, now I'm gonna do it. Like, business is done.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Okay, so just explain, you know, what is DIY MFA? It's obviously a book, but it's a community. You've got all kinds of things going on. So what is it? And I guess, why did you create it in the way that it is?
So it's evolved over time. Now it's essentially a school of thought, as it were, or a curriculum, an approach to creative writing. But I've begun actually toying with this idea of expanding beyond creative writing, because I feel like the pillars of DIY MFA apply to most creative fields. But basically, the three pillars are sort of what hold up this idea of the do-it-yourself MFA or a, you know, education in creative writing. So you have the writing piece of the puzzle, and that's your creative output. It's like getting the words on the page, mastering the craft, staying motivated, managing your time, managing your creative energy, creativity, getting ideas to flow, and all those things. The reading piece is the middle one, and that, it's funny, most people gloss over that one, but it's also the one that people tend to latch onto the most. Like, the people who get it and really get what DIY MFA are the ones who really appreciate the reading piece. And that's all about you know, reading with purpose, it's not just about reading anything and everything, but it's about having a strategy. Mm. And it's not, I know we might touch on this later, but it's not about sort of never reading for pleasure again. It's just about understanding that you can turn that switch on and read like a writer, read with purpose when you need to, and then you can kind of go back to coasting and doing whatever you want. And then, of course, there's the community piece of the puzzle, and that involves both building a community with fellow writers, building a community with readers, and actually building a platform so you can sell your work. This is especially important for indie publishing, but these days it's basically for everybody. Mm. And then, of course, there's the connecting with the publishing industry, understanding the business side of writing. So those three pillars are the three pieces of the puzzle.
Yeah, and they're really great. And I want to come back to your writing process, because you started with the children's MFA. You've written this nonfiction book. You're a podcaster. You blog. How did the process of putting together? And actually, the book, I think, is, like you say, a curriculum. You're very structured. Like, the book is very structured, very organized, and I thought, you know, very well structured. Credit to you for that. It definitely is really packed full, but it's very well organized. So how did your own writing process work, especially as someone who's had this kind of MFA training?
So it's funny, because I tend to write like a designer. Like, my brain, I think, is wired more like a graphic designer than a writer. I just happen to like the writing piece a little bit more. So it's weird. Like, when I used to write essays for the MFA program, and I'd actually outline them with the subway map outline. And my teachers would be like, I don't know what to do with this. And I'd be like, well, okay then. But it's sort of something that, like, even comes before DIY MFA was a thing. I was already sort of thinking in terms of the visual structure. So I think that is sort of just me. And it, unfortunately, like, I can't really give writers advice and say, like, this is how you can be more structured, because for me, it's just like, well, it's how my brain thinks. Like, I kind of just visualize things. And for me, it's very much a visual thing. But I mean, the big thing for me, as far as having all these balls in the air, it's, for me, it's like switching activities is the break, so I can always be in motion. I'm not a person who can sit and do nothing. Like, even when I'm watching TV, I'm knitting something, or I'm crocheting, or I'm doing some sort of craft or whatever, because I can't just sit still. And maybe I have something I need to work out. But aside from that, it means that, you know, I kind of need to always be working on a project. And I've been like this since I was a kid. I mean, my mom used to worry that I start art projects every single day, and she'd be like, oh no, not another trip to the art store. Oh, so yeah.
Yeah, no, that's great. And so, but you managed to then fill in the blanks, because there's a big difference between, in fact, it's funny you say that, because I got lost in my plot recently, and I was like, just draw a picture, because I was a business consultant and would always draw pictures. It was just easier. So I drew a picture of my plot on just one page, and, you know, the various things. And then I was like, oh yeah, I get it now. And then you saying that, I'm thinking, why don't I, because I really struggle with outlining, you know, on Scrivener or a spreadsheet or whatever, but you can outline with visual stuff too, right? But then Absolutely. There's a long way between the visual outline and a finished book, and that's a long book, right? It's a chunky book. So how do you get the words on the page? What type of writer are you in that way?
So for this book, I tried a few different things, and I try to practice what I preach. So that whole chapter on iteration, like the very first chapter in the book, where I talk about doing a word count and testing and seeing if it works, and then switching things up, I literally did that. So I started out thinking I'd write this book on sort of mini writing retreats, because I was trying to juggle doing this and working here and then also writing this book, because I didn't want to put my job on hold to write the book. Otherwise, that would tell me that I can't write and run DIY MFA. I have to pick one. So, and I didn't want to make that choice. So I needed to find a way to fit it around it. So I thought, all right, we'll do these mini retreats. The first one went really well. I was super stoked. The second one was not good at all. And at that point I was like, okay, this is going to be a very expensive book to write. If I'm going to have to like go and stay at a hotel every time I need to sit down and write, like that's not going to work for me. So I decided to, I got myself in a rhythm where I would literally walk my young son. At the time he was 3 and a half. And so he was just starting preschool. I'd walk him to school first thing in the morning. And then there was a Starbucks right around the corner from his school. And I would go, I'd sit in Starbucks until it was time to pick him up. He went to school in the mornings. I'd go back to school, pick him up at around 11:30, 11:45, walk home. And then the rest of the day was my day job. And that gave me a very finite period of time that I knew, like, I needed to get stuff on the page right then, because that was going to be gone. If I, you know, the minute, if I didn't show up to pick him up, he would not get picked up from school. And let me tell you, there were some days when the teachers were like, are you serious? Seriously, woman, what's wrong with you? But yeah, so that for me, that's what worked. But I have no idea if that's going to be the rhythm for the next, you know, the next book or the next one after that. Like, that's sort of the thing with writing, right? A lot of people think, oh, you get into your system or you find that magic pill, that like, you know, perfect solution. But the thing is, every day is a different day. And yeah, you can find some consistency that works for you, but after a while, you might have to switch things up again. So it's having that ability to step back and look at your process and say, hey, is this still working for me? Mm-hmm. And then make adjustments accordingly. And that's really what DIY MFA is about. It's about honoring and understanding that your process is going to change and that you need to be aware of that and then make adjustments as you go.
Mm. Yeah, no, I agree. And I've, you know, I've moved continents, you know, in countries and cities. And the only thing that probably is the same is that I listen to Rain and Thunderstorms. I've been listening to the same album of Rain and Thunderstorms for like 8 years. And it works for me. I think it just puts my brain into some kind of state. But, you know, I agree with you. The physical place may change and, you know, as our lives change. Okay, so I have lots of questions because there's so much in the book. So I'm going to ask you one question on writing and then we'll get into the reading and community and stuff. So I'm going to ask you about the editing. So can you explain your editing or revision pyramid? Because I think it was, and you've got lots of these good diagrams. So let's go with the editing or revision pyramid. What is that? And please explain it.
So the revision pyramid, it's based on Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And so that's a psychology term, probably remember it. Maslow was the guy who came up with this idea that, you know, you have this pyramid and the stuff at the base of the pyramid, you sort of work your way up. So at the bottom of the pyramid were things like, you know, food, water, shelter, like the sort of basic necessities to survive. The way up, you have like relationships or safety, I guess, is the next one. And then relationships and then feeling like you've achieved something. And then finally, like self-actualization and inspiration and creativity is like at the very tippy top. And I started thinking, you know, the original idea came from hearing an author speak at a reading, and someone asked, like, how many times did you revise your book? And the author said, I revised it 38 times. And the author, you know, the whole audience gasped. And then she said, but I didn't revise everything for each time. I'd go through once and I'd only look at this, and I'd go through again and I'd only look at this. And that was the moment where I realized, like, oh, you have permission, or we have permission as authors to not look at everything with every pass of revision. So that kind of planted that seed. And then I saw Maslow's hierarchy of needs. I was reviewing some psychology or whatever. I remembered it. And I thought, well, that could really work for revision. So the revision pyramid is basically the same idea. You start with at the base of the pyramid with the things that your book needs the most, or the things that will most deeply affect your book as like the whole organism, right? Mm-hmm. So in my mind, the most basic element is the narration, because that's what establishes the reader-writer relationship. The way you choose to tell the story, the point of view you use, the voice that you use, that's really the fundamental piece. It's also conveniently the piece that by the end of your first draft, you've pretty much nailed down. Like, you've sort of figured out, like, yeah, you might have written some scenes in different points of view, or you might have, you know, messed around with different voice or style. But by the time you get to the end of like that first messy draft, you know what the voice is, you know what the point of view is. So it's kind of like you get a free pass because you can check off that layer of the pyramid after you've done the first draft. And then as you move up, you have, you know, character, you have the story structure, you have the world building, the scenes, and the, I guess scenes are, world building is part of scenes, and then the details. And the idea is that you're kind of going broad to most narrow. And as you go through your book with each pass, you're tackling smaller pieces of it at a time until eventually you're really just kind of dusting it off and doing little cosmetic changes. The other key thing is a lot of people start at the top. They'll start with like
typos.
Correcting grammar. Yeah. Or typos.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, if you scrap the whole chapter, you've just wasted an hour of your time, you know, doing a line edit on that chapter. That was a waste. So this sort of avoids that problem of fixing things that you might discard later anyway. So that was sort of the inspiration behind it.
Yeah, and it still amazes me that some people think editing is fixing typos and grammar, whereas that really is the least, you know, important thing. And in fact, recently I read, you know, being an indie is great, and I pick up indie books, and you know, sometimes it's just like, okay, this really did need some work, but I've just read the whole book because the story was so good that it pulled me through. And even though there were some typos, and I'm not saying we should leave typos, but you know, sometimes a story can be the thing that pulls you through. So I totally agree on that. So I do want to ask about reading, because this reading with purpose, I think, is a great point. And many authors worry that by reading books in their genre, they will accidentally plagiarize or somehow affect their own creativity. I'm one of the opposite view. I read everything I can in my chosen genre, one, because I enjoy it, but two, that's how I like to learn. So talk a bit about reading with purpose and how people can do that and not worry.
So there's sort of two things to that, right? And for, I think the idea of having the reading infect what you're writing, that's something that as a writer, people have to gauge for themselves. I, for instance, have certain times when I'm working on a project that I can't read other stuff that's related to that project, because then it will seep in. And one of my sort of paranoias as I was writing the DIY MFA book is I was worried I was going to somehow accidentally borrow writing advice from people who I wasn't trying to borrow from. You know what I mean? So like there was a point where I had to sort of set a limit and say, okay, Gabriella, you are not reading any writing advice books for a chunk of time because you got to just focus on your book. So there is sort of a level of setting those boundaries. As far as reading with purpose in general, though, and sort of how to do it, again, I like very clear instructions. I'm a very logical left brain person. So, you know, when I started thinking, okay, what would one have to do in order to basically build the equivalent of a graduate school reading list, right? Like you go and you're taking a graduate course on Nabokov and you know, get a reading list from the professor. Only guess what? As the writer, if the course in literature is basically stuff related to your book, you get to set the reading list. So I started thinking, what books would go on that list? Well, you need some books that are similar, like some comp titles and whatnot. But then you also need to expand the scope of that. And you need to look at, you know, books that would inform your book but aren't necessarily in the same genre, or books that might be useful for research purposes. You also want to take a look at some of the classic books. And even if they're not related to your genre or your topic. And then you also want to know what's new, what's the contemporary stuff. So you kind of want to find a balance between those things. And I'll give a concrete example. At one point, I was writing a middle grade manuscript, and I'm still playing with it. I might go back to it someday. But it was basically a retelling of Homer's Odyssey. But with like involving kids. So I started by reading the Odyssey and reading the Aeneid and reading the Epic of Gilgamesh and all of the sort of travel epics, like ancient travel epics. But then I started thinking, okay, well, there are a lot of like on the road books, like, you know, Jack Kerouac and like sort of, you know, road trip stories. So I started looking at those to see how contemporary road trip narratives tended to operate. And then I started looking, okay, let's look at some middle grade travel narratives. And I looked at some of those stories. And so eventually I was like, okay, well, now let's see what's actually new in middle grade right this second. Because if I'm writing middle grade, I kind of need to know that too, even if it's not a road trip story. So eventually I kind of cobbled together a list of about 18, 20 books that, you know, I didn't read all of them, but I'd sort of go through some of them and like get a sense of like, okay, this is the body of literature that informs this project. And for me, I found it really helpful because it meant I didn't have to go to the library and get lost in like stacks and stacks of books.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to do it. And, you know, I find that research side of things to be one of my favorite parts for books. And also, I think that we have to remind people that there's no copyright in ideas. The copyright is in the expression of the idea. And you can retell Homer's Odyssey until the cows come home and it will be a different book. Also, that's out of copyright anyway. So.
Yeah, public domain.
Yeah, like, yeah, whatever. So let's talk about the crafting your author identity, because I think this is really interesting, especially coming from the more literary end of the scale where a lot of the MFA people are. So you talk about this author identity. Is this something different to the real person? And how is this done effectively when an author is just starting out? Because often I don't think you really know who you are as an author when you're starting out.
So it's interesting because, you know, I use the word author identity to basically mean your brand as an author, right? But I find that most writers don't like the word brand, like that freaks them out. As a designer, like the designer side of my brain is like, well, yeah, it's your brand identity, duh. But, you know, like that's, you know, for me, it's like I'm thinking like a brand. So I'm thinking like, oh, yeah, FedEx logo. But the idea with the author identity is, A, it's not a fixed thing. It's not like you just sit down and decide this is my author identity and it will be like this forever and ever and ever and no one will ever change it. I mean, look at like Miley Cyrus. Like she was Hannah Montana at one point and now she's, you know, so even like people change their identity. They're reinventing themselves. I mean, there are a lot of celebrities who are masters of reinvention as they go through their careers. And so understanding that your author identity is fluid is one thing, but then there's also a consistency to it. Like you need to, yes, you can change things, but it's sort of like it's like changing outfits. As you grow more mature, you might go from wearing, you know, skinny jeans and like t-shirts to wearing maybe a business suit, but like it's still the same person underneath. And so that like person is consistent. And as far as like, is it the same, is your author identity the same as you? The answer there is yes, but no. Like it's basically the polished version of you. It's the version that you want people to see. So, and the examples that I often give is like, you know, there's a lot of hot mess that happens behind the scenes. Like when the doors of this office are closed, there's a lot of, you know, tearing of hair and gnashing of teeth. Even the way I am explaining the tearing of hair and gnashing of teeth is a way of explaining it. It's certainly not the way it actually looks. Because that would really not be appealing. Like people would not want to see that. So like you have to understand that like there's a point where you need to be intentional. And it's not about being fake. It's not about trying to be someone you're not. It's not about trying to put on a persona or something like that. It's just about being authentically you, but presenting your best self to the world. And it takes practice. If nobody nails it from the get-go, one of the best things about starting out is that you have very few followers. So if you mess up, no one sees it. I love that part.
That is such a good point. And what I also think is interesting, so we've had the girl on the train, Paula Hawkins, and I got really angry about this because she won debut author prize of the year, whatever, something in England. Now, obviously, Girl on the Train is massive. It is the first book by Paula Hawkins, but it is not the author's first book. It is, even though it was billed as a debut book, it was a debut book by an author who was already previously published under another name. So they had basically reinvented her to try and start again, which I think is, it's not just a publishing industry thing. There's, you know, pseudonyms are very, very common. And in fact, this week, as we're talking, Elena Ferrante in Italy has been unveiled, you know, unmasked. And, you know, and I mean, who cares, really? I mean, we've got J.K. Rowling as Robert Galbraith. We've got some big, big names doing things under pseudonyms and things. So what are your thoughts on this kind of use of pseudonyms to reinvent brands, I guess?
I think I would drive myself crazy if I had to do that. Like, I have enough of a hard time keeping one identity on track. It would make me completely nuts to have multiple identities. I mean, like, seriously, as far as like the ethics of it, I mean, there's no like law against it. I say that if I were a fan of the book and I found out that that author was pretending to be something they're not, that's going to shade my perception of them. I'm going to trust that author a little bit less. And the thing with trust is that it's sort of like with every book, the reader and the writer are making a pact. Mm. The writer is saying, I am going to bring it. I'm going to really just bring it on the page. And the reader's like, okay, I'm going to go for a ride with you. I'm going to go along for the ride. And the writer can stretch that trust, and you can do it in the craft. You can do it in the way you present yourself as a writer in your author identity and your platform, et cetera. But eventually you stretch too far and it breaks. Mm. So I think that's a choice that the author or the publisher or the, you know, publishing machine makes. And that's their choice. Because for me, that trust with my readers is just way too important.
Yeah, I think it's difficult. I mean, I have Joanna Penn and JF Penn, but the thought...
But that's a calculated choice. That's
absolutely.
For a strategic reason. That's not like to, you know, reposition one identity as a debut. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
it's not.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, this is the thing. I think about this quite a lot, especially, you know, with romance authors, for example, mostly use pseudonyms. So it's something that I find very interesting. One of the benefits of being an indie author, of course, is you can do this stuff very easily. Whereas as traditionally published, it's very hard to change your author name. You know, once you've been published under a name, that's, you know, traditional publishing has always kind of said, oh, well, this author has dropped off, but we could do it under another name. So I think it's quite a common practice. So let's talk about the publishing industry a little, because I mean, obviously, when you first went to do an MFA, you must have had a dream of traditional publishing. It would have been your thing. This book, the DIY MFA, is traditionally published with Writer's Digest. Is that
correct?
Who are great publisher of writing books. What are your thoughts on, I mean, you now have a lot of authors who come to you looking for advice. So what are your thoughts on the changing side of publishing, and what are your kind of recommendations, or and your thoughts on the myths that get people into this in the first place?
Well, I mean, oh my gosh, so many answers. Well, for starters, yes, there's a lot changing. But the one thing that doesn't change is the fact that authors have and always will have a seat at the table, but they often don't think they do. So especially when writers are starting out, like we almost put the publishing industry on this pedestal, like, you know, to get an agent or to get an editor or this, that, and the other. And I'm not going to lie, there were definitely times where I felt like, you know, I had the whole agent fangirl moments. But the truth is, when I connected with my agent as an intern in the agency, like I knew him as a person before I pitched him as an, like, to be my agent. And, you know, as with my editor, like, I met her at a conference. Like, we had a nuts and bolts conversation about what this book could be before we even considered having a book proposal sent to her. So I think there's a point where I think writers forget, because it is so hard, because it isn't like this stuff doesn't drop out of the sky. So it's easy to kind of put all your eggs in that one basket. And so you forget that you have a choice, and that you, when you do make a decision to publish traditionally, it is a business decision. And I mean, my husband is a lawyer. And so I've always sort of been absorbing through osmosis sort of lawyer stuff. And he's always saying, like, it's better not to have a contract than to have a bad contract. So at the end of the day, if it's not something that's going to work for you, you need to walk away. And I think having the option of indie publishing, I don't think indie publishing should be a second place decision. In fact, I find that when authors do go publish indie, because they've sort of as a reflex reaction to not getting an agent or not getting a book deal that they wanted, et cetera, that's usually a recipe for disaster.
Yeah,
but
agree.
I think understanding that, you know, if this contract over here is not up to your liking, it's not take it or leave it. It's take it or go and do this other thing and make it the way you want it to be. But sort of understanding that the author, at the end of the day, the author drives the ship, right? Because like without the author, there's no book, there's no actual words to publish. So understanding that, you know, it's not to like act like we're divas and that we're going to be like crazy diva authors, but at the same time, understanding that like we are part of the business machine and we need to operate like we are part of the business.
Mm, and in a professional manner as well. Which,
exactly.
Which, you know, it always amazes me when you see some behavior, you know, of authors. You know, I used to think that publishers and agents would just up themselves in some way. But when you see the behavior of some authors at conferences, or you actually see some submissions that happen, it's just like, yeah, I understand why they're a little standoffish in many ways. So if you're a professional, you're right. You can actually, you know, meet them more easily, I think, if you behave in a professional manner.
And honestly, like, I'll even add to that. It's funny because, like, you know, you do have some, like, there's some real crazies out there. I'm not going to lie. Like, I go to a lot of conferences and there are some people who are, you're like, oh, I feel really embarrassed for you. But the truth is, for most of the people watching this or listening to this podcast, you already know how to behave yourself in a professional manner. You've got this. Just be normal. Be a person, be helpful, be genuine. It's, you know, for this summer when the DIY MFA book launched at the Writer's Digest conference, I did this like pilot program, a special sort of intensive where about 150 authors sort of had some pre-conference prep with me. And then I sort of walked them through the conference. And one of the things we worked on was sort of the conference networking skills. Mm. And it's one of those things where like, it doesn't have to be rocket science. It doesn't have to be hard. I think people work themselves up because they think like, oh, you have to be a wheeler and dealer and you have to schmooze and da-da-da. Mm. And it's like, you really don't. Just be a person, be your awesome self. And you know, that if they don't like it, then go be your awesome self with someone else. But like, it is what it is. Like, just be a person.
Yeah. So. And I guess circling all the way back to the beginning, the journey that I've seen many people go on is the, you know, that kind of imposter syndrome and worrying and then behaving in a certain way. And then once they're empowered, they choose to go indie anyway. Because as soon as you're empowered and you don't need the validation, then, you know, often the business choice can be indie, which is certainly what I chose. So we are pretty much at the end, but just tell people like a little bit more about the book and also where they can find you and your podcast and everything online.
Well, the DIY MFA book is out now at like all the main places where you would find books. And you can find me at DIYMFA.com. You'll find links to the podcast there. You'll find a link to the book there. You'll find links to all that awesome stuff there. So yay, come and visit. And please join our Word Nerd community. We have an email newsletter and also a Facebook community, a private Facebook community. And it's really an awesome group of people. And we, you know, good discussions going on in that group. So it's really fun. So be part of it.
Brilliant. So thanks so much for your time, Gabriella. That was great.
Thank you so much, Joanna. This was a blast.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. You can also get your free Author 2.0 blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.